This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to New Books in South Asia, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I am Sneha Anavarapu, your host for the day, and today I'm in conversation with Kunal Purohit, author of the brand new book H-Pop, The Secretive World of Hindutva Pop Stars, published in 2023 by HarperCollins. Kunal is an independent journalist based in Mumbai, India, and writes on issues of development, politics, inequalities, gender, and the intersections between them. His work can be found in the Hindustan Times, India Spend, Al Jazeera, South China Morning Post, The Wire, First Post, amongst many other such publications. H-Pop is his first book, and I'm really excited about our conversation. I hope you enjoy it as much as I did. Hi, Kunal. It's so great to finally get a chance to talk to you about this book, H-Pop, which is, you know, I've been recommending it to everyone. I just thought it was so interesting, terrifying, but also really well written. And I just felt like I was with you as you were taking us through all of these different scenes and sites and people that we were meeting along the way of the book. And I really appreciated the way it was written. Thank you.
Sneha, what a pleasure to be here. What a pleasure to be with you, because, you know, I've been waiting for this podcast for a very long time now. I know that we started speaking about it a couple of months ago. And I'm glad that the book, you know, sort of resonated with you in some ways, if I can say that. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to our chat.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it resonated and it reminded me of so many people in my life that I was also thinking about how all these echo chambers are not actually echo chambers, considering the influence and the persuasion of the Hindu right wing right now. So Kunal, before we begin talking about the book, I would really love to get to know you a bit better. So how did you become a journalist? Can you tell us a little bit about your journey into journalism?
I mean, I think I'd say what we typically say and I'd joke about, which is that the one who couldn't do anything else became a journalist. And in my head, I mean, you know, I knew I wanted to be a journalist since I was in school. So I would really enjoy reading the news. I mean, my father used to read the newspaper for a couple of hours straight. And, you know, I mean, I would just emulate him without really understanding what the news was all about. And then the next thing I realized, I was hooked onto them. So that was really the starting point for me. Mm-hmm. And then I started off as a print reporter. This was about 17, 18 years ago. While I was still in you know, junior college, and I started working early. I think I wrote my first piece when I was 16 or so. I've only known journalism, and that is really how I got into it. But once I was here, I mean, I realized, you know, the power that it also sometimes has, Sneha, in, you know, changing people's lives, in being able to make meaningful contributions to not just, you know, people's lives, but to policy sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. To be able to throw light on issues that sometimes never really get heard and get reported about. Yeah. And then in some ways, the book is really an extension of that, where, you know, what I saw in rural and semi-rural India, mm-hmm. was a story that no one was really trying to tell or no one knew of in the mm-hmm. urban part of India. Right. And, you know, so this sort of world of Hindutva pop was something that came up in my reporting. And I mean, the idea remained the same. The idea was to try and tell more and more people about what was happening in the country. So in some ways, the book is really like an extension of my journey into journalism and my time there, yes.
Awesome, thank you. But to get really quickly, I guess, to the kernel of the book, what I thought was really interesting is how you explore the rather unexplored territory of popular culture by Hindu right wing, right? So you look at music, you look at videos, books, and even poetry. And I really like this one sentence you had in your introduction, in which you say, what makes propaganda so effective is its everydayness, the easy access that it has to its prey. And you show how catchy songs, poetry at Kavi Sammelans, social media influencers, and even books are constituting this world of pop culture where Islamophobia and just vile, vicious hatred against minorities and really anyone challenging the Hindutva model of being is normal or normalized. So I was curious first to hear from you, how did you start thinking about this book? Like, when did you decide that you're going to write a book about Hindutva pop? How did it all begin?
So, I mean, you know, in fact, the journey to writing this book has been rather organic in some ways, because over the last 6 years or so, you know, since 2018 especially, is when I started looking at hate crimes. And you know, so I started looking at mob lynchings. I started looking at communal riots. I started looking at events which were, you know, sort of causing or had stoked communal tensions across the country. And each time I would you know, go to such a place where an incident of this sort had happened, I would, one thing that I would do is look at all of the media reporting that had already happened about the incident. And typically my visits would be a few weeks or a few months after the incident. What I did realize, you know, was a major shortcoming in the way that we were looking at these events, as not just as media persons, but also as a society, is that we were looking at it as exactly that, as events. You know, we thought these were events which had no past, which had no future. They were just these, you know, flash in the pan things that happened, and then they dissipated into the air. But the reality is actually very, very different from that. And then one thing that I wanted to, you know, very, very seriously explore is the process that led up to the event. You know, because as I saw it on the ground, the violence that happened was a result of the process. It wasn't just the violence itself that was important to study. It was also the run up to it, and you know, just how everything was building up to that event or that violence. So in my search or in my quest for sort of trying to find out what that process looked like, I reported on a number of things that I've been reporting closely on social media disinformation, which is what we see everywhere, right? We see it on WhatsApp, we see it on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter and Instagram and so on. But there was also in the journey, I realized there was also one crucial element that, you know, none of us were able to really put a finger to. Which was the rise of pop culture, you know, and this pop culture had been, you know, sort of weaponized and made so difficult to sort of capture, that it was slipping in, and as you read out, it was becoming a you know, sort of this thing of everyday communalism, where people were now just consuming pop culture. They were not necessarily consuming any other form of hate speech. They were only consuming pop culture, and slowly that was also radicalizing so many people out there. And in the book, I talk about, you know, some of these instances where the consumption of such pop culture and particularly songs, particularly music and poetry, as well as books, how consumption of all of these genres of pop culture has resulted in, you know, instances where tensions have really sort of you know, being stoked. Sometimes instances of violence have happened as well. So I really just wanted to understand, you know, how that was happening. And it's in one such reporting trip that what I call the world of Hindutva pop stars really, you know, sort of opened up to me. And since then, I've only been trying to get more and more information out there, try and understand it better, and try and understand who these pop stars are. I mean, who are these people who are really creating this popular culture, which is so fused with Hindutva?
Yeah, I think that really came through, just the focus on the everydayness of also their lives. And we'll talk a little more about that very soon. But before we get to the meat of the book, the one thing that I kept thinking of was, like, you know, how did you do the reporting and also just the work, like, as an ethnographer, I call it field work, but how did you go around investigating these pop stars, right? Like, how did you get the access to their lives? What did they think of you? And how were they responding to you? Were they Googling you? Were they finding out things about you? So I was just curious about the process of getting all of this information.
No, absolutely. So, you know, I remember the first time I approached all of them, they were all taken aback because, you know, they were never approached by an English language journalist before. They'd featured in some regional media outlets, you know, here and there, but there'd never had been any sort of prominent coverage about them in the English media. So they were very suspicious at an initial stage as to just what my motivation was. But, you know, here's what I told them, Sneha. I mean, I said what I believed in. I said that, you know, you might be extremely popular in the worlds that, you know, sort of you live in. And there are millions of people who follow you, you know, people sort of come for your events and so on and so forth. But there's a large part of the country that has no imagination of your existence, you know. For that large section, you don't exist at all. And for that large section, the idea of Hindutva pop culture is something that is absolutely absent at this point. And then my job really is to bring your stories to light for that audience. You know, so I will want to understand your stories. I will want to convey, you know, what you do and then why you do in your own words. I mean, I don't want to be mediating that too much. And that's something that I've attempted in the book as well, where I'm not demonizing any of them. You know, I'm not calling them names. I'm not falling into the liberal trap of, you know, sort of criticizing them and saying, oh, this is you know, this or that. And I'm not doing that at all. What I'm simply trying to do is take the reader through that world of Hindutva pop and some of the actors and what their motivations are, but also importantly, what their point of radicalization, as I call it, is. You know, why is it that they actually finally chose the Hindu right wing, the Hindu nationalist ideology? You know, even with all of its hardline elements, what is it that sort of attracted them most towards Hindu nationalism? So all of this, you know, wouldn't have been possible if I was just sitting there and judging them. They very well knew what my politics was, and they knew that I'm not someone who agrees with their brand of politics. But I was extremely certain in my head that I didn't want my politics to interfere with that conversation that I was trying to have with them. So, you know, that's something that I always remember, that I'm there for the story. You know, I don't want to be the story. I think it's a lesson for all of us journalists, especially in these times, that we're not the story. I mean, you know, the story is what matters, not us, not our politics, not what we believe in.
Right. I think that's really well put. And I completely agree. I think through the book, I didn't get a sense that there was any judgment. I think you did a really good job in kind of taking us through their rationales and their self-narratives, right? And then leaving it for us to decide where we want to go with what we are reading, right? But I was also wondering, were there people who refused to talk to you? Were there people who didn't want to be tailed or shadowed?
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, so there was one, you know, I don't want to take her name, but there was one sort of influencer at that point, and this was at the early, you know, conceptualizing stage of the book in 2019, who was really keen to follow because I was seeing how she was rising through the ranks of the Hindu right wing. By the sheer fact that she would come online, she would come on Facebook, she would do these live sessions with people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, from a few hundred to tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands, that's how the reach has grown in the last few years. So much so that she is now, you know, actively going around and delivering hate speeches across the country. So someone who just started off, you know, like pretty much like what I'm doing now, talking into my phone in the confines of my home, goes on to then become this absolute sort of rock star in the Hindutva world, where she's going around and delivering hate speeches. So she was actually one of the first choices that I had for the book in terms of one of the three subjects that I profile on. But, you know, after a very long time of sort of, you know, playing along and saying, oh, she'll do it. She finally refused, saying, you know, the Hindu right wing sort of handlers of hers were refusing to let me in. Because they suspected that I would sort of sabotage some of the work that they were doing. So you know, you do face that, but with these three especially, it was tricky to get access sometimes. But you know, since my reporting was also spread over 4 years, it meant 4 years of, you know, being acquainted with them, getting to know them better, and also building up a a healthy relationship where we could disagree as well sometimes, and then where I could sort of, you know, very openly and honestly also question them about their work. So I was glad that I was able to manage that, and I think a lot of that has to do with the time that I took in writing the book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure my publisher will agree with the time.
I think all great things take time, is what I also done myself as I'm procrastinating on a book manuscript. But I think
I should have that on my wall somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. So coming to the three, stars of the book, Kavi Singh, Kamal Agni, and Sandeep Deo, three of them are prolific in a different kind of media, right? And was this also a deliberate choice by you? And, you know, I would love for you to say a little bit about each of them in your own words.
No, so I'll introduce all three, to begin with. I mean, so Kavi Singh is this 25, 26-year-old singer from Haryana, who's never sung a song in her life before 2019. And, you know, one fine day, her father, who's a very famous Haryanvi singer called Ramkesh Jivanpurwala, he is just walking past while she's cooking in the kitchen, and she's humming a song as she cooks. And that's enough for him to be convinced that she can sing. So the next morning she's in a studio recording songs, and the first song that Kavi records is a song after the Pulwama terror attack, in 2019, where around 40 paramilitary soldiers of the Indian forces were killed in a suicide bomb attack. And in that moment of grief and outrage and anger, you know, that you and I sort of experienced and felt, because it was the single worst terror attack in peacetime on our paramilitary forces, Kavi comes up with her song, which is a maiden song, which says, you know, guys, let's not blame the terrorists, let's not blame Pakistan, which was popularly believed to be, you know, sort of at least aided the suicide bomber, according to Indian media reports. Kavi's song says something very different. She says, you know, these guys are not to be blamed. Let's not even blame Pakistan. You know, if we need to blame someone, let's blame implicitly, and she implied this, let's blame the Muslims who are living amongst us, because they're the ones who've been responsible for the day. And, you know, as a result of that kind of rhetoric, not just with her song, but with a lot of other people saying that, what we did see in the days to come, Sneha, if you remember, is that Kashmiri Muslims across the country were attacked, were heckled. They were evicted from their homes, from their college hostels. So, you know, we saw that building up, and that really was Kavi's first song that sort of catapulted her into fame, into virality, into the limelight in so many ways. So since then, she's created a song, you know, for every major occasion in the Hindu right wing ecosystem. She has a song which tells you how Muslim men are luring Hindu women away, and doing something that she calls love jihad. Similarly, she has a song which talks about how the Muslims of the world are conspiring to sort of impose a demographic coup on India and on the Hindus of India, and outnumber them very soon. So, you know, she'll have a song on everything that there is. So that's Kavi. And, you know, these songs are not just on YouTube. She also goes around and performs across the country. So she goes to smaller places, smaller towns, villages, and she does these concerts where she performs to audiences. That's Kavi Singh. The second character is this poet called Kamal Agne. Again, similar to Kavi, he will have a poem. I mean, his core is obviously Hindutva poetry. And he does everything he can to peddle the Hindutva narrative through rhymes, So what he does is he will have poetry on the past, you know, the sort of revisionist past that the Hindu right wing enjoys to circulate. He will have poems legitimizing that, but he'll also have poems which you know, talk about present day issues. It will attack, you know, the Muslims. It will attack sometimes the Christians. It will attack critics of the Modi government. So it will essentially do what the Modi government and the BJP want to do, but in the garb of being a nationalist poet, you know, and that's what gives him so much more credibility. And the third subject in the book is this guy, as you call it, Sandeep Dev. His mission is to fight and to wage a cultural war that he believes a number of entities are waging against the Hindus. And in these entities, I mean, you know, there are obviously the Muslims, the Christians, he calls it the Vatican, you know, but there are also entities like Netflix. Mm-hmm. There's also Amazon. Yeah. Oh, he believes, and he convinces his followers to believe, are all conspiring against India and against Hindus in their own way. You know, so he's constantly telling his followers that, you know, Hindus are under threat from all of these characters, and I am the one who's out there to protect you. So what he does is essentially, you know, he started his own publishing house, and the sole aim of the publishing house is to produce books which will essentially toe the line that he's spelled out and constantly legitimize some of the historical narratives, but also some of the more contemporary ones about how Hindus are facing an all-out attack, you know, of sorts. So that's really about all of the three, Sneha.
Yeah, and it shows the breadth of the kind of pop culture reach, as you're putting it, each almost specializing in a different kind of form of reaching out, right? But I will say that Sandeep Dale's, I think, gave me the chills, mostly because I went on their website and there were a lot of books, as I was telling you earlier, that I remember then being shared by some of my own family members, and the reach of the kind of press, and you link it so beautifully to historically the Gita Press, right? Like the kind of right-wing oriented publishing that has such a wide audience in India. It was a bit scary to see its newer, I guess, avatar. And I also remember thinking how interesting it was that Sandeep is constantly vigilant about the words that he uses in his videos, because he's terrified that they are going to take the videos down from YouTube, right? So there's so much, I guess, juggling going on that front too, about how to escape censorship from these Western platforms and how to really put forward like a Make in India kind of narrative there. But I think one thing that tied all the three together, and there are a couple of things, of course, one was just the sort of personal, I guess, trauma to a kind of sociological explanation as to why Muslims are the enemy, right? So could you speak a little bit about how each of them had these personal encounters, either a friend that stopped being their friend or some kind of an incident that one would maybe want to think of as minor, as constituting almost like a meta-narrative in their heads around why they are right? And as you keep pointing out through the book, despite facts showing otherwise.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. So, you know, one of the things that I always wanted to do in my active reporting was to try and, you know, really understand the genesis of you know, right-wing thought in a person. Right, especially a person who's a foot soldier and who wants to go out there and do something about it. You know, and I used to always wonder, how is it that the person even got there in the first place? Mm-hmm. But you know, active reporting doesn't really give you the luxury that you need for something like this. And which is why I was very keen in my book to try and do that, mm-hmm. Which is to take all of these three and try and understand what their early lives were like. You know, were they exposed to Hindu nationalist thought as kids? Was it something that was, you know, very organic, or was it something else? You know, and what I did find, I mean, as you hinted to, is that I found that there were their own personal experiences which sort of, you know, took them very close to you know, the Hindu right wing thought and sort of some of the most hardline beliefs among the Hindu nationalists, right? So some of these thoughts resonated with them a lot more than it would otherwise because of some of their own experiences. And you know, in this regard, Kamal Agne, the poet in the book, his experience to me is fascinating because, you know, here is this guy who growing up has, you know, has his father's best friend to be a Muslim. You know, so growing up, he told me how he would go to the Muslim friend's house, the Muslim friend would keep coming over, you know, the families were very thick, and you know, he would touch the Muslim friend's feet as a mark of respect as well every time he saw him. And yet in the journey between the two friends, between Kamal's father and his Muslim friend, there comes a point where they have a very bitter fallout. Mm-hmm. You know, and for Kamal's father, you know, the fallout really felt like a betrayal because it was a betrayal of his trust on his Muslim friend. I mean, the genesis of the fallout was something commercial, and mm-hmm. you know, so Kamal's father felt really heartbroken at how things had turned out. And Kamal was still very young, but when he saw his father, you know, sort of going through all of these emotions, feeling absolutely broken and angry and dejected that his best friend would let him down like this, Kamal was obviously soaking it all in as a kid, right? But he couldn't make sense of what was happening. But a few years later, Kamal starts getting involved with local Hindu right-wing groups in the area that he's living in. And you know, the more he gets an exposure to their ideology, the more they try and tell him that, listen, Muslims are all terrible people. You know, this is what Muslims do. Muslims will betray you. Muslims as a community will do this. So, you know, here is Kamal, who's carrying all of that trauma from his childhood, suddenly getting an explanation for what he had experienced. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I remember him telling me, he said, you know, I'm sitting there and it almost sort of makes me understand what had happened to my father was not an aberration. You know, it was the norm, because it was not the friend who was bad. It is the community which is bad, and the community, everyone in the community would do the same. So a lot of them, for instance, they found an explanation, you know, about sometimes their deepest fears, sometimes their deepest concerns, sometimes their emotional baggage and their trauma. And then they found explanations in the Hindu right-wing thought. And that is how they also get attracted to the ideology, which I find fascinating. I mean, you know, so I think it also just serves us an important reminder that this in this era where we're all so polarized, we're not mm-hmm. talking to each other, where the communication between people on two different sides of the political aisle has broken down. I think it's important to remember some of the motivations that people can inherently be carrying when they embrace ideological positions one way or the other.
I think that's a really good example. I was also thinking of Kamal Agni's example, in fact, and it was also making me realize that there is trauma, and there is a kind of personal wounding, then there is a certain explanation for it, and then there is a context or a time in which there is power, right? Like, and that is when it turns absolutely deadly for minorities, right? Like, otherwise, sure, like, I don't know, I've known people having these sorts of personal ideas around the community, but it does not matter till it actually starts to affect other people's lives. And we see that happening in all the three cases, how these personal events sort of become they become reasons to peddle hate, and for there to be a certain like larger condition possible in which that can really take off.
No, absolutely. And you know, I also want to add here, I think the other thing that's also happening is that, as you said, you know, we've all been carrying these biases somewhere, right? Growing up, you know, I can talk about myself growing up in India, and growing up, you know, in the shadows of the violence around the Ram Mandir in the 90s. Mm-hmm. I remember, you know, being born into a Hindu family, I remember that there used to also always be these biases that people would talk about, you know, about Muslims in a certain way.
Yeah, yeah.
What has happened now, Sneha, is that, and I think the pop culture, the Hindutva pop culture, mm-hmm. has a very big role to play, yeah. is that it's normalized a lot of those biases. Mm-hmm. It's normalized a lot of, you know, a lot of the sort of the hateful speech that we would sort of always observe. Yeah. What it's done is that if I am a man who has secretly always believed that right. Muslims are going to, you know, sort of outnumber the Hindus at some point,
yeah.
I am now listening to a song which is being, mm-hmm. which I can see on YouTube, is yeah. being heard by millions of other people. Mm-hmm. And the song essentially is repeating my fears. You know, so I'm sitting in my home saying, okay, so I'm not the only one, clearly. Mm-hmm. Clearly, there are millions of other people who also believe in this, and hence this must be real. Yeah. So you know, this, which is why I mean, this everyday dose of communalism yeah. has gone a long way in normalizing a lot of the biases, a lot of the prejudice that we've all been carrying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think as in the book, you so rightly point out to how the tempo, the beat, even the aesthetics of the poetry, or just the writing, the persuasiveness of the prose in the books that are being sold, all of these matter. Like, the form matters to how the content is then popularized or becomes viral, right?
or resonates, to use a word that that you know we often use so innocently, but it really does resonate in that very tangible sense. And I was also thinking about how many times that I've had relatives show me videos that have become viral that are hateful. They'll point to the numbers actually and say, see, this is so popular, they all can't be wrong, right? Like all these people who are liking it, right? So the numbers actually don't just indicate a popularity, they reproduce it almost. Like they it becomes a reason for it to keep on then becoming the gospel truth of a certain kind.
Yeah. 100%. And you know, this is the effect that numbers have on human minds. Mm-hmm. But the other effect that these numbers do is that they're almost telling social media platforms that this is the content that you need to actively keep pushing.
Yeah.
Because this is the content that people are enjoying.
Right.
So what's essentially happening is all of these social media platforms in their own way are not just facilitating, but you know, platforms like YouTube are also actively funding some of this content.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, where it's telling these pop stars that if you make hateful music, even if it's calling for violence against Muslims, even if it's calling Muslims an existential threat, and it's wishing evil on Muslims, I am giving you more money to go and make more such content.
Right.
You know, I'm giving you money to get better with your production values. You know, I'm giving you money so that you can get a better tune this time. It's literally all of these platforms telling these pop stars that this is what is happening. So what we've seen is the numbers really play a very, very big role in not just, you know, making people have a sense of confirmation of their biases, but they're also pushing platforms to continuously incentivize the people who are producing this kind of music.
Yeah, in a kind of infinite loop of sorts.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely terrifying. But the other thing, I think, that was very interesting, and again, this we know, but it was also interesting and terrifying to read in your book, was how all three have actually much more complicated relationship with BJP than one would assume, right? Especially Sandeep Dev's case of him going to Kashi and then just becoming this sort of anti-Modi crusader of sorts was really, really interesting. So I would love to hear more about how the BJP and RSS to a certain degree fit in the worlds of Hindutva pop.
You know, Sneha, I mean, I think most people, and I think I call it the lazy liberal trap.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that the lazy liberal trap is to associate everything in the Hindu right wing to the BJP and the RSS. You know, it's easy because it's lazy because it's easy. You don't have to investigate it. You don't have to really think beyond that. Most of us, you know, just sort of say, oh, you know, this must be funded by those guys.
Yeah.
But the truth is slightly more difficult to absorb, which is that a lot of this is also organic. And a lot of this is organic because there are now a significant chunk of the Indian population which is enjoying and which is really wanting to patronize some of these pop culture forms. You know, so I just want to also clarify, which is why, I mean, I think I want to clarify that even with these guys, and I get this question a lot, you know, saying, oh, but they must be funded, right? They must be getting paid. And I said, they don't. None of them have had sort of the start to their careers thanks to either the BJP or the RSS or any other Hindu organization. But, you know, they've all had very independent sort of beginnings to their careers. What happens on the way sometimes is the BJP and you know, the Sangh Parivar really sometimes gets to understand what the popularity of some of these characters is. It tries to sort of encash on the popularity by offering their platforms to these guys, saying, you know, we're doing an event here. Why don't you come here and perform your poetry? Or why don't you come and sing a few songs for our audiences, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there is that kind of sort of symbiosis that often takes place in this world.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing sometimes can also happen that the BJP sometimes can get some of these people to campaign for them in the elections.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken about this in case of Kamal, but also in case of another singer who actually, again, hails from Punjab. But his song just before the Uttar Pradesh elections of 2021, his song went absolutely viral, right? And his song, he literally said, the people who brought Ram back, you and me should get them back, you know, which was campaigning for the BJP. So in Hindi, the song's words were, jo Ram ko laye hain, hum unko layenge. UP mein fir se hum bhagwa lehrayenge. You know, so people like him, again, you know, makes this song independent of the BJP. But the BJP, realizing how effective the song is, quickly, you know, offers him all kinds of platforms. So what happens then is that he's flying from one camp, one sort of electoral meeting to another for the BJP. And he's singing the same song again and again and again. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's sometimes also how the relationship shapes up. It's not always that, you know, these people are actively funded by the BJP mm-hmm. or the RSS. But of course, they benefit from each other. I mean, the BJP benefits from the mainstreaming of the Hindutva thought. So does the RSS. And similarly, so do these pop stars, because they benefit from, you know, having the networks and the resources where their work gets bigger platforms sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so how does it work when there is disillusionment, right? Like both in the case of Kamal and in the case of Sandeep, we see a certain disillusionment with the higher echelons, I guess, of BJP. And that also then relates to, well, I think for Kamal, it related more to a personal situation, whereas for Sandeep, it was much more about how, in fact, the BJP and RSS are moderate Hindutva. They're not Hindutva enough, right? So how did you encounter those instances?
It's interesting when you look at their world. I think what one does come across is, I mean, very simple in some ways, right? It's mm-hmm. it's that at the end of the day, despite their ideological commitments, mm-hmm. They have a sense, they have an expectation of some kind of a reward for all of the work that they put in.
Yep.
What happens is, especially when they see that their work is being used by, you know, by the BJP or the RSS, mm-hmm. Or is being actively sort of, you know, recycled in different forms. Mm-hmm. To cater to a growing audience, when that mission is successful, so sometimes when, you know, when all of these guys go and campaign for the BJP, and when the BJP wins an election, as stakeholders, they feel that they have every right to claim their own sort of pound of flesh, mm-hmm. which very often doesn't really come their way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they get something, but you know, very often they don't, because they're not the only ones. There are so many other sort of actors like that who have contributed in their own way to the BJP's victory. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that, I mean, over a period of time, there is a sense of disillusionment that builds up, because they've gone ahead, you know, with the expectation that the reward will come. Mm-hmm. In Kamal's case, for instance, what he sees is that, you know, he's not getting any reward for, you know, his poetry and his Hindutva work. But at the same time, the people who, you know, till a couple of years ago were anti-Hindutva or were, you know, were never really foot soldiers of the Hindu right wing. Mm-hmm. But they were popular poets, you know, they were popular artists in those places. As soon as the BJP government comes to power, instead of, you know, luring people like Kamal, who were dedicated foot soldiers, a lot of the governments would then go back to those, you know, those established guys who ideologically had no commitment to the BJP. Mm-hmm. So you know, some of them feel that the BJP and its ecosystem around it is rewarding the big names who are not ideologically driven, mm-hmm. and in the process ignoring those people who had actually waged the ideological war to bring the BJP into power, mm-hmm. And as a result of which they often find that, you know, that they want to possibly go their own ways, or, you know, they don't want to be associated with the BJP. But it's a tricky situation to be in, Sneha, because at this point, the BJP is the most dominant political force, and especially the most dominant Hindutva political force, right? So if you don't want to be associated with the BJP, where do you really go if that is your brand of politics? Yeah. So Sandeep, I mean, I don't want to give out money. Yeah. Sandeep has charted his own sort of, you know, political journey away from the BJP and yet remaining firm on Hindutva. Mm-hmm. But, you know, for others like Kamal, the options sometimes are rather limited. So, you know, despite the disillusionment and sometimes the anger, people like him just stick on.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I'm glad you didn't give away much of Sandeep, because I do think that there is a certain structure to this book where you get a little bit, and the way the arc goes is very, very interesting. So everyone should actually I'll read it to know what happened to Sandeep. But I also was curious about something that came up early on in the book, which is that the pop culture world seems to be pretty gendered, right? And you look at Kavi Singh, who is, of course, a woman. And there was Lakshmi Dubey that you mentioned, who you tried to, or like you did not tail because she did not end up becoming as much of a viral sensation as Kavi. So I was curious, are there, have there been more women influencers, pop stars in the past few years since you started doing research? If so, what is their trajectory a bit different from what you see in the male pop stars?
So it's interesting because, you know, the gender question has always been a very interesting one when it comes to the Hindu right wing and generally sort of the Hindutva ecosystem. But we've seen, I mean, you know, since the last few decades that women have played a crucial role. I mean, be it Uma Bharti, be it Sadhvi Ritambara, you know, all of these people have played their own very, very important role in the larger sort of struggle. But they've never really risen to leadership positions, right? And even now, if you look at the BJP or I mean the RSS, for instance, has you know has no women representation, at least in its top sort of you know leadership. When you look at the BJP, you find a very similar sort of situation where it still remains a very very male dominated party. You know, so what I saw was within the ecosystem of these influencers and pop stars, it was a very similar story where, you know, there were not too many women. And as a result of which, the few women who were there would stand out because, you know, they were women, right? So Kavi sort of benefited from that where she was, at that point especially, she was the only woman who was, you know, doing this on a regular basis. Lakshmi Dubey was a woman who had sort of given some chart busters, but then she went silent for a very long time. Whereas Kavi was regularly, you know, dishing out a song every month, every couple of weeks, and so on. What I do find is that even with Kavi, it becomes a very interesting sort of aspect to look at because she's a woman in the Hindutva pop space, but you know her clothes are sort of again, I mean, you know, she wears exactly the same clothes that Narendra Modi wears. You know, she'll wear a kurta, she'll wear a pajama, so the trousers and a shirt. And then she'll wear a jacket, you know, she'll wear the Nehru jacket. She also wears the pagri, which is the turban on the head. And you know, this is not a common sight among women at all in India, right? So what you see is, you know, despite her sort of trying to create her own identity, sometimes, you know, she does feel the need to, you know, sort of take up more masculine, take up a very masculine presence. Both in front of the camera as well as in the world around her. You know, so she tells me how she, when she dresses up as Kavi Singh, she doesn't do a few things. So in her head, she's playing this character, you know, who's sort of wearing all of these clothes and who behaves a certain way, right? And then when she's Kavi Singh, she's way more aggressive as a person. She's way more assertive as a person. Whereas when she's just Kavi, she's no longer any of these things, you know. So it's very interesting how the question also plays out in their own heads.
That's really interesting. And I was also thinking of Snigdha Poonam's Dreamers as I was reading it, because it was yet another book that I think really put out some harsh truth out there about radicalization of young people, but also the kind of gender and politics sort of intersection, but of course in a different context about women student leader. But I was thinking of Kavi and what that case can tell us about gender in the Hindutva ecosystem. So yeah, I think the kind of masculine presentation is very, very interesting, but also the relationship she has with her father, right? And that kind of dynamic then playing out and shaping her presence as a star was, I think, quite fascinating to learn more about. The other
But you know, I also do want to add. I mean, because you asked about how, you know, that world is shaped up after
starting reporting
as well. I've seen that this pattern, Sneha, does keep repeating itself. You know, where you find women influencers, including the woman influencer I mentioned at the start, who refused to be a part of the book, and you know, she's now sort of all around town. She's also very similar in the sense that, you know, her sort of presence is extremely aggressive and assertive when she goes around. You know, she sometimes will use very harsh language. So she, you know, none of them conform to those to those stereotypes of how a woman, especially how an Indian woman, you know, should particularly be.
Yeah.
Right. So they're constantly trying to break that stereotype. But all this while obviously still doing the Hindutva line. So there will be women who will, you know, sort of go out and say these. And then they'll also, you know, sort of talk about in the victimhood. So they'll also say that, listen, I'm a woman and I know, you know, you should not fall prey to Muslim men, you know, because Hindu women are foolish, you know, and they're very innocent and they don't know anything. And then Muslim men are so much, you know, I mean, they're smarter, they're very clever and they can lure you out. Yeah. So, you know, there's this very interesting juxtaposition of themselves being the empowered ones, while other women are you know, are dumb and foolish and very vulnerable. And they keep on reiterating the position. So I've seen that happen quite a bit.
Yeah, that is an interesting tension there. And I was thinking about that actually, in a way, throughout the book, in a different way, right? Like about, say, for instance, Sandeep, both wanting to be the victim as well as being the sort of superior to the other, right? So there is that playing both sides almost. And I guess that is maybe an enduring definition of power, is the ability to play both sides in many ways. So the other, I think the final sort of question, the big question I had for you is, what is the afterlife of this book, right? Like, have Kamal, Kavi and Sandeep wanted to read more of it? Have other people reached out? Have you, I don't know, faced a certain kind of backlash for the book? I know you've got a lot of praise and all well-meaning and very excited, but I was also wondering about the underside of writing a book like this at this point of time.
I mean, you know, so there's definitely, I think, a certain kind of consequence that one faces while doing critical journalism in today's India. And I think some of it has also come my way in the sense that there is intimidation, you know, that sort of often comes your way. For instance, you know, my Amazon sort of page where the book is listed got attacked a number of times.
Oh, wow.
You know, so the Amazon rating was what, 5 or something. And then suddenly I think the you know, the book link was circulated among Hindu right-wing groups. So suddenly I had, you know, a lot of people descend and write reviews saying it's a terrible book. And none of them were, you know, verified customers, because that's the badge you get. None of them had clearly read the book. But, you know, suddenly I got, within a few days, I got people saying, terrible book, this is anti-Hindu, you know, this maligns Hindus and so on. And so the book rating fell to a 1 or something, you know. So you see stuff like that. I mean, there's also, you know, intimidation on the internet where people sort of troll you. One of the things that they did was, as soon as, I think a few days after the book was out, is that, you know, someone started, I mean, there are these trolls who follow me on Twitter. And each time I would talk about the book, they would put out a link which had the PDF version uploaded of the book. You know, so each time I would talk about my book, they would tweet it out saying, no one should buy the book, please read it here. You know, so that sort of a thing, which was also funny in its own ways. But you know, there's so stuff like that. I mean, that is something that one does come across. But I think, as I said, I think it's a part and parcel of the job, especially in these times.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess you must have expected that. I'm sure your publisher did too, to a certain extent.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one just has to sort of take it in their stride, because I've seen this before as well, even when it comes to my reporting, that, you know, each time you put out critical reporting of issues from the ground, you do get trolled, you do get abused, you do get intimidated. But, you know, that is no reason for you to stop doing what you're doing.
Yeah, well said. So what are you working on now? And is there another book in the making? If so, can you give us a little bit of a hint or a teaser?
Oh, God. So, I mean, I'm petrified of the question, because I'm meeting all of these authors who've written about 8-9 books, and they say, what's your next book? And I said, well, I don't know yet. But I mean, you know, this, I think the book still has quite a bit that I want to unpack, you know, just in terms of not just talking about it, but actually seeing it in operation, because we're now sitting, what, less than 2 months away from the biggest election that this planet has seen in some ways, right? Which is the Indian general election. And popular culture is going to play a very, very important role in shaping the outcome of the Indian elections. And, you know, my book talks about music, about poetry and publishing. But the next frontier of this sort of weaponization of popular culture is cinema. And, you know, I mean, I'm in fact just trying to report on how cinema has now been weaponized in so many ways to push out the Hindutva thought. Right. So we're going to see some of this in operation, and I'm going to keep following this closely. So that's the answer that I tend to give people each time I face this question. Yes.
I think that's a great answer. And I was actually also just thinking of cinema when I was reading the book too, about just also Bollywood cinema and the kind of catapulting to the Hindutva, I guess, agenda of sorts. Absolutely. And Tollywood, all these other regional cinemas as well. So thank you so much, Kunal. I don't want to take up more of your time, but this was so great. It was such a fascinating conversation. I lost track of time. But yeah, it was really great to, in a way, like relive the book with you. And I have taken so many notes and I keep going back to it. And I really look forward to reading more of your writing and learning more from your work.
Thank you so much, Neha. It's been an absolute pleasure and also an honor, because, I mean, you know, I've seen your work and thank you for all of the nice things that you said. Thank you for the engaging questions that you presented. I mean, made me think a bit about my own book. And yeah, I hope that people do read. I hope that people do engage with just how Indian society is changing at this point. I mean, you know, I think engagement and understanding is the first sort of step in trying to resolve some of these issues. So I hope that people do engage with the worlds that they're not seeing beyond their limited social media feeds. So
absolutely. Couldn't have said it better. Thank you again for taking time out.
Thank you so much, Neha. Thank you.